I haven't talked to you since last year.
You know, I've gone the whole year without someone saying that to me. That's really unfortunate. Street broken.
Yeah. Just starting the year off right. Have you upgraded to Ruby 3.4 yet or tried it?
I literally just logged into Slack, bro. Like, give me 30 minutes.
Did you have most time off since Christmas?
I have had since like December 21st off or something like that.
Nice.
No, wait. We had the 20th off too. Haven't worked since the 17th, I don't think.
I didn't do a lot of work, but I did some in between. Brooke had pretty much the same kind of like, today's her first day back and hasn't really had to do anything for a couple weeks, which is nice. This morning before we started recording, I was going through and updating gems, doing the old bundle update. It's kind of cool. Like the new bundler 2.6 adds two things. One is they've normalized the platforms.
I saw that.
Darwin 22, Darwin 23, Darwin
24. Ubuntu dash blah, blah, blah.
Now it's normalized, I guess, which is nice.
ARM 64.
You still need those, but you don't need the like versioned numbers of those, which is good.
I can live with that.
So you still need Linux and whatever else, but not the like 23, 24, 25 for the same platform. So that's nice. The other cool thing is the checksums, which we enabled on Jumpstart, and it's optional. And we may unenable it just because it's going to create more merge conflicts for people. But it's kind of nice because that will double check and make sure that when you install a gem in production, it is the same checksum as the one you were testing against. And that will help prevent man-in-the-middle attacks or trying to inject their hijacked version of a gem or something. I think that's a great security improvement that I'm looking forward to.
It's worth saying that this is what Ruby Central does. Which is, by the way, because I hear a lot of people say, we don't know what Ruby Central is. This right here, these bundler security updates and these updates to Ruby Gem security, this is what Ruby Central does and why we support Ruby Central and why you may want to support Ruby Central.
You should support Ruby Central because this is the stuff that keeps our community strong and secure by default type stuff that matters a whole ton. It's almost invisible because it's implemented so smoothly, which is why it's easy for people to take Ruby Central for granted. But do not do that because they are the ones keeping your life.
They need grants, not for you to take them for granted.
Boom.
Boom. Roasted. Speaking of security, I see you got that sick new Honey Badger t-shirt on. I love that shirt, dude.
Yeah.
That's a nice shirt, dude. I wore it home for Christmas and I was like, Mom, feel this shirt. Like, feel how nice this shirt is.
It's so good, which I'm sure you can get your own at the next conference that Honey Badger is sponsoring.
Did you have an instant-free Christmas?
Yeah, I think. Well, at least work-wise, I don't think there was anything really that happened hardly. We even had way less support tickets and stuff than normal, which was great. I think people were enjoying the holidays, and so we didn't have a whole lot going on, which is great. Ruby comes out on Christmas, so I took a little time to go compile it and whatever, like day after Christmas. But for the most part, everything was smooth. Jackson had a great time. Now that he's two, he's able to like, oh, I know how to tear open a present and like enjoyed it a whole lot more. When he was one, it was something's happening. I don't quite understand. And this year he was into it. So it was a good time. Did you do any traveling?
I went home for Christmas. Yeah. And then I came straight back. Yeah, I did fly. But I flew American the day before everything happened. I was like, whew, that would have.
I don't think I knew what happened.
There was like a system shutdown. Like, dude, shout out to all the IT workers at American Airlines that had to work over that this holiday. Dude, it was a disaster. They grounded tons of flights because of like some IT issue.
Was it just American?
Yeah. Something in their system.
The old Americans.
Hey, man, it might not work well, but when it gets there, it'll get rowdy. I was reading horror stories on Reddit. Like people just, I can't imagine.
Did you watch that Carry On movie on Netflix with Jason Bateman?
I don't have Netflix, but I did watch Squid Game, and I won't tell you how, but I did watch it. Season 2.
I haven't watched season two yet. We were talking about that the other night.
I enjoyed it. It pissed me off. It's like a part one of two thing. I hate when studios do that.
I saw something they said that season three was already being recorded or filmed or something.
I feel like everyone needs to know that going into this, because if you're like me and the end, you'll need to know that, because let me say, season two, fantastic. When I got to the end and saw that they ended in the middle, I was like, are you serious right now? That made me so angry.
Yeah, that's one where I'm like, okay, now I don't have any rush to watch it. I'll watch it later just fine when I can go through the whole thing.
It was fantastic, though. Very much exceeded expectations. I thought they were just going to do like a hit or rewind on this. Let's just make some more money. But no, really like a very good story.
That Carry On movie was good, too. It was like Jason Bateman trying to smuggle something in through TSA. And he's like trying to hold this one guy's family hostage, who's a TSA agent. The main character in the movie is the one who ends up being the guy who they go after or whatever. And it's a pretty good movie. I was impressed. Now that your flying travels are over, you can watch that without any...
That wouldn't bother me. I'm a numbers person, dude. Like the only moment that I hold my breath for even a second is like when we take off. Because I know that statistically, that's when we're going down.
But you haven't taken off yet. How are you going down?
Dude, we'll see. Sometimes what goes up does go down.
I was just like in the same boat, and I was like, I haven't watched a good movie in a long time.
Nah.
All the movies in 2024, and I was like, there's not a lot of ones that stand out that I really want to watch. Like Gladiator 2.
Yeah.
I like the first Gladiator. I just watched that again, but then
I'm not going to watch
the second one didn't seem that great. And it's just the typical thing of like, well, that movie was popular. Why don't we just like follow that one up and make more money in a sequel? And I'm like, where's the creativity again?
Dune 2 was good.
Ooh, I did like Dune.
Dune was good. Dune 2. I actually liked Furiosa.
Oh, did you?
It succeeded my expectations. And I think that's why I liked it. Because I was like, okay, I thought this was going to be shitty and it wasn't. And I was entertained. Yeah, and I've not been entertained by a lot of movies recently. Like I watched Civil War this year. It sucked.
I remember hearing about that one.
Venom sucked. I liked one of the other Venom movies with Tom Hardy, but I'm just like, we sucked.
Yeah.
It sucks.
I've been playing on my Steam Deck the Mad Max game.
Really?
Which is like, you roam around and you go to these little camps and like blow up their fuel tanks and collect parts that you invest into your car, and you got a suite of cars and whatever else.
Sounds like very Fallout-y, minus the car part.
Yeah, it's a pretty good game. It's just kind of like a nice little thing to play on the Steam Deck, you know, if you got a free hour or something.
I've been looking at the Steam Deck. I have something to admit, and it's going to let a lot of people out there know exactly the type of person I am. I just hit 10th prestige in Call of Duty last night on Black Ops 6.
Do you know who Kim.com is?
Yes, I do.
Did you know he was number one on Call of Duty back in the day?
No, I've seen
number one player of the world. That's how I envision you. Like,
I'm not the number one player in the world, but
you're just on the legal gray area and just play Call of Duty the rest of your free time.
I've definitely been trending towards chaotic evil. Like as I grind this Call of Duty more and more, there have been things that have really made me upset.
I highly recommend the Steam Deck. It has been great. I read a little bit of the story of the guy who made Balatro, the poker game.
I want to try that, dude. One of my coworkers.
It was on sale like 10% off or something. It's only like $15. I read a little article about the guy who wrote it, and it was just like somebody wanted to make a game, and I forgot the details of it, but it was like he didn't really have that much experience making games or whatever. And it's like a roguelike card game. You like go play a round of cards, like a flush will give you a number of points and a multiplier. So then you have to hit like 300 points your first round, and you have like four hands you can play, and you can discard cards and then play whatever you want, full house, whatever. When you hit the 300, you go to the store and you like earn some money for beating that round. Then you go to the store and then you can buy other cards that will manipulate your deck. So you can add cards to your deck. You can delete cards from your deck. You can make cards play as any suit. You can do all kinds of different things. And then you can get these like planetary cards that will apply like a better multiplier to like a flush. So you end up like stacking as many of those as you can. So your flushes are like going to get you 10,000 points at a time. And then you get jokers, which will do weird stuff to the entire game, where it's like, if you play three hearts, it will multiply your score by X. And you just like go build up this deck as you're playing. You start out with basically nothing. And then you figure out, how do I want to tackle this? Do I want to just play two pair and just like go hard on that? It is pretty tough at the beginning, but then you get into unlocking a bunch of these extra things as you go, and it gets addicting. And it's just like playing these poker hands. It's one of those games that I love because I don't have to like really sink into it. I can just pick it up for 5 minutes and play a little bit and put it back down. That's kind of the life I live these days with video games. It's like in between Jackson watching Bluey or something, I'm like watching a little bit of Bluey, playing some games, but can't really get into too depth on anything.
I've been hearing a lot about Balatro and I'm very tempted to try it out. I don't know why gambling got so popular, like betting, but dude, like my friends are sports betting and they're sending me all these like wins they're hitting. I'm like, no, don't do it. Don't do it.
You're lucky not to. I was just watching CoffeeZilla on YouTube talking about the CSGO gambling sites. Oh,
dude, my friends were into that, dude. I had friends make tons of money. Dude, I lost so much money on a Hawk to a coin, bro. Yeah, dude.
We'll just leave that one there. Speaking of scams and stuff like that, did you see the Honey browser extension scam?
I didn't get to see what was actually like in it, but I saw that they got like exposed for something. But I always figured that was a scam.
Yeah, right. Like it's at the surface, it's a great idea. You install this thing and then during checkout, it'll just scan for codes and try to apply them to your checkout. And like people have known this for a while, since like 2010, but the Mega Lags video on it just kind of like reopened that whole thing. You'll appreciate this as a developer. So Honey is owned by PayPal, and PayPal is kind of notorious for not having a great reputation.
Didn't PayPal buy them though?
They did, but they've been continuing to do this. PayPal owns them for a long time.
Okay.
So their business model is actually to steal affiliate codes from people. So here's what happens. So let's imagine they sponsor your podcast. You have affiliate links to wherever. You are supposed to be getting revenue from your affiliate links. Well, a lot of the affiliate links are last attribution. They can be first attribution, which is like the first person that sent you to Amazon gets credit for the referral. Well, even if that was the case, what Honey does is they show up right at checkout. So even though you have sent them to Amazon, Honey is like, hey, you want me to test this out and see? They swap the affiliate code cookie with their own. And all you have to do is click like the button on the checkout page. And what's great is even if they do not have any coupon codes, they show a pop-up that says close or whatever, continue. You click that, they still steal that affiliate
code.
No, they didn't do anything. It's even better. So now let's pretend you're the business selling stuff. You can become a partner with Honey and you can tell Honey what coupon codes are available on Honey. So you can become a partner and say like, well, Honey, people will get 3% instead of 5% off or whatever, or nothing. And so they can control all the stuff that Honey picks up and they're still stealing those affiliate codes even during that process. So they're just making crazy amounts of money just stealing from all these creators and all these affiliates. It is wild.
I think this is awful, number one. Number two, this is genius. Okay.
It really is.
Someone really cooked over there, dude. Smart.
It is so shady and everything, but yet it is such a subtle thing because as a customer and even as a business owner, you don't really know. Was it actually Honey? Was it Amazon? Whatever you're like, the only thing they really keep track of during checkout is that one affiliate code. And it overwrites the old one. So it's not like they have an array of affiliate codes that was like, they came in first from so-and-so, and then it became Honey. They can't even go back and like analyze how many things Honey has stolen from other people. Aside from probably 100% of them, you could assume that if it was Honey's affiliate, then yeah, they probably stole it.
That's
and it's such
wild.
A subtle thing because it's just a cookie in your browser that's basically invisible to anybody, you know, unless you're like us, happen to be poking around during checkout on whatever site it is. I think at first, like back in 2010 or something, there was a thing about this, but it didn't blow up as much
yeah,
as
yeah, I heard about
last
that.
Week. So it's just so subtle where it's, yeah, you know what? They probably are doing this, but whatever. And then now people are pissed about it because it's like they sponsored
some a bunch of YouTubers. Yeah, something. I used to see their videos all the time.
Like Mr. Beast and KBHD, Linus Tech Tips, like huge channels. Linus Tech Tips was like featured in that video as one that they were stealing from or whatever. And it's like LTT had dropped their sponsorship 4 years ago because they knew they were stealing affiliate codes. And they commented on it and it was like, yeah, that's why we dropped them. Well, what more do you want us to say? That's how it is. That's what they do.
It's so wild. I feel like this entire conversation is why we should be using signed cookies and signed global IDs and just making sure like that you're secure about the things that you store in the browser that can be manipulated and seen by users and then sent to your server.
Yeah, it's tough because it's like some of that stuff is used for legitimate things, legitimate purposes. But then how do you track one of those things in the overrides and whatever else that's going on?
The affiliate tracking is just hard in general.
It is.
We do some of that at Podia and it's very tricky.
It's easy to abuse where you're just like, I'm going to sign up for an account myself and use my own affiliate code and then I'm going to get the product for free.
And I don't want to mention what product it was, but recently I showed my brother something and I was like, yeah, if you use my referral code, I can get a free blah, blah, blah. And he's like, wait, I want free blah, blah, blah. I'm just going to make 10 accounts real quick, which he did, which I was like, cool. That's a thing that you can do, apparently. And I was like, surely like someone on the back end will see this. But I was like, no, these people are probably like, they're just using a drop shipping service. So they're never going to see that.
Right. As a business owner, you have to make sure that like the conversions only happen after money is exchanged hands or something, or even after like 30 or 60 days after they've paid as a customer. Because you can end up with, okay, I ordered it and then I got my free thing and then I contact support and I ask for a refund, but I still get the free thing or whatever. It's like so easy to abuse. We've like talked about doing affiliate stuff in the past and I think we did for a little while and it was just like...
I made money off Jason through Podia.
Yeah, I think I'm still a Podia affiliate or something.
Give me one sec. I'll get that cleared up. I'm just going to send your referral link to mine, bro.
Yeah, just install my browser extension.
Yeah, sure. Chris, can you install this Safari extension real quick?
So I have an idea. We can make a browser extension called like Agave.
Okay.
And it's very similar to Honey.
Right.
But it's just not Honey.
But it gets you drunk.
Instead of it going to PayPal, you could at least go to more trustworthy people.
Like us. Like our PayPal. Well, while we're at it, I have got some meme coin ideas that we can launch this year. I think this year we rug pull our audience.
Yeah, as long as we
tell them it's a rug pull, they still buy it. That's not our fault. We claim plausible deniability, dude. Right here, we're going to play this exact clip in court in a couple months.
And the court's just like, yep, let them go.
That's all
I need to hear. They're cool.
Dude, if I can mint... Dude, I saw a meme coin on Solana today that I'll tell you about after the show. If someone could be making $6,000 from this coin right now, then I should be making money from this.
Dude, I still look back to like, what was the name of that ape thing for NFTs?
The Bored Ape.
Man, I still can't believe how much money people are paying for that stuff. And I haven't heard anybody mention NFTs for I don't know how long. It is crazy.
I got an email from a service that I signed up for a while ago, like accidentally. And they were like, hey, by the way, if you sell off all of the crypto you have on this one coin, then you won't have to pay $800 in taxes on this. And you're losing money from this. So this is actually going to help you. And I was like, shoot, you're right. So guess who is not paying all that crypto capital gains tax next year?
Yo, quick question for you. Do you want higher clarity into production, but don't have the time to become a wizard in observability? Honey Badger Insights is exactly what you need. Forget the old school trio of logs, metrics, and traces. We're talking structured events that don't just sit there. They're your treasure map to solving mysteries in your app. With Honey Badger, sling your logs and events into the mix and voila, you just unlock the power of Honey Badger's new query language, BadgerQL. It's like having a conversation with your data. Ask it anything, turn mishaps into metrics, and showcase your wins on dashboards that even the marketing team will drool over. And guess what? This isn't just for big spenders. Honey Badger's got you covered with a free plan that packs a punch, including error tracking, uptime monitoring, sleek status pages, and more. Oh, and speaking of errors, Honey Badger treats them like VIPs at the club. With Insights and BadgerQL, your errors aren't just problems, they're opportunities. Explore your data in ways you didn't think were possible and get the insights that you deserve. Check out honeybadger.io. That's right, honeybadger.io.
So we're talking about Ruby on the blockchain. Anything else that came out with the Bundler Ruby updates?
The new version 2.6 is included in Ruby. I can't think of much else. We did a couple Go Rails videos on like the it keyword in blocks now. And, you know, those other little features that we talked about last episode, but not too major of updates. I did stuff on the frozen string literal things. That is one that I've started to go to all the open source projects and force that to raise errors in CI.
Ooh.
Where I don't have to do it in applications necessarily. It's good to do that.
Right.
But ideally, like all my code is going to be compatible with frozen string literals. Pay had like one thing that was like taking a first and last name and concatenating it or whatever if there was a last name. And so that was like basically it. For example, in that one, it's like I could just like concatenate them. No, what was it? Because it was a frozen string somewhere. It wasn't that exactly, but anyways, it was something like that. Just like one place, super easy fix. You can toss both of them in an array and join or whatever you want to do. Like make a new mutable stuff is not a big deal.
I just make the string. Like I just do the string interpolation if it comes down to that.
Yeah. You can also like do a plus in front with the unary operator, which I've like never seen anybody really use. But honestly, that's the other part of the frozen string literals is like almost nobody is really using that anyway. So like,
well, I think that's credit to RuboCop, honestly. I've only seen frozen string literal true coming out of RuboCop. And a reason why a lot of us have been using that inner project is because of RuboCop. So shout out to them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And also, it's just not that common that you have a hard-coded string in your code that you mutate. That's kind of really the only case that this actually applies to for the most part. And so it's not that bad of a situation. Like when you run into it, it's a pretty easy fix. So
yeah.
I just was like, oh, you know what? We should just get that implemented everywhere and force it in CI, especially even in our Rails applications.
How do you force it in CI to raise?
There is a Ruby opt environment variable where you can say like --- enable frozen string literal. That's the easiest way to do that. At least with your libraries. Like if you run a ton of libraries, you might run that on CI in your application, and then you got to go fork some gem in order to fix that, which like hopefully the maintainer will merge that and happily accept a PR pretty quickly and you can get that fixed permanently for everybody. But that's the main thing is like library wise, I can do that because I control the entire code base. When it comes to my application, I'm using third-party libraries for a handful of things like OmniAuth or whatever. And if somebody's OmniAuth strategy plugin happened to mutate a string literal, then I'd have to go fork it or whatever. But honestly,
that's
why
I'm hoping
it happens that much.
I'm hoping RuboCop really, that's why I'm betting you RuboCop being that as the default will probably really bring down the limit that you'll run into that.
I wonder if that's one of the rules in the Omakase Rails RuboCop rules.
Standard doesn't do it.
Oh, it doesn't?
No.
Interesting.
Yeah, I noticed that. Standard does not do it.
Huh. Yeah, I was going to say the Omakase rules are next to nothing. So my guess is no, but it seems like it wouldn't be a bad thing to encourage today so that people are ready for Ruby 4, but that is still a ways off. I don't know how many in the 3 that we'll still get. I know 3.5 was mentioned before, I think, but I don't know if 3.6 or...
We got all the 2.6, right, last time?
2.7.
Oh, we did get 2.7?
Yeah.
I remember 2.6. So maybe, I think that was the one that lasted the longer time.
Yeah, probably. Because 2.7 was kind of just a lot of the last changes before 3, preparing people with deprecation warnings and whatnot so that it was easy to do the major upgrade. But I don't know if there is any major plans for Ruby 4. This is one of them, the frozen string literals. But the only challenge with that really is like backwards compatibility. Like old libraries and old Ruby scripts and whatever won't be able to run on it, which sucks. But it's one that like isn't that hard to fix, which is good. I really think it's not that bad. If you happen to have done it, it's an easy mistake to correct. And then like Mike Parham in his post, I think it was 2.7 or something, that was when the frozen string literal stuff originally came out. And he showed like at least a 10% performance improvement, because when those strings are defined in your code, they're not going to be allocated, then garbage collected, and doing that every single time. It's just going to happen once. And most of the cases in our Rails apps where you have strings that are hard-coded might be like a has many, and you have to specify the class name and you specify a string there. And that's really going to only run once in production when your app boots. In development, it might happen a few times because the reloader reloads that file or something, but it still only runs once in the class definition. So the most significant time where it will happen would be at the instance level, hard-coded strings there. And a lot of times when you got hard-coded strings, you're not like manipulating them much. Oh, I think it was my prefixed IDs gem had something with it, because it's generating IDs or like string IDs, which makes sense that it's kind of like define the prefix, then define the ID and join them together or whatever. So I think it was shoveling something together and it's like, okay, we'll just interpolate or join the strings and that'll work fine.
Since we're talking about frozen strings and boot time and like what gets put in and what doesn't, I have run into this many times before, and I'm just going to put it out there in case you run into it, in that I use Flipper a lot, and I have made the mistake a few times of putting a Flipper ternary into a constant definition, and that does not work because that gets set. And then that's set, and then it doesn't get reevaluated. So whatever the value is at the time that it runs is going to be what it sets the, like the value of the ternary to. So all this to say, don't put conditionals in your constants because those get set right at boot time and they don't get recalculated.
Yeah, that's a subtle one to run into.
So now imagine you need to like change the value of a constant, but you need to have that behind a feature flag and you're using that constant in like validations and stuff. Like, dude, it can get a little tricky.
If you make a method and you have like a default value and you say that's dynamic, like time.current or whatever.
But time is an object though. Isn't time a class?
Time is a mystery.
Time is a mystery.
But what I'm saying is something where the default value will change. Some languages would evaluate that when it gets
run
first time or whatever, when the method is defined, and it would just cache the value. But I think with Ruby, those get updated whenever you call that method. It reevaluated then, I believe.
Not in my instance.
Def hey with x equals time.current, and then we'll print out x and we'll call hey, and I get one time, and I do it again, and I get new times every time I run it. So yeah, it does evaluate the default values when the method is called. So it stores that code somewhere and just evaluates it later, which is cool. I'll type this out in the
chat. I'm a visual person. I think what I always end up just making a method. I replace the constant with a method usually, or I make a new constant and then make a method that will call the
example. Or you define, hey, the first argument is x equals time.current in Rails, at least, or active support.
Right.
And then just print out x. That will print the current time every time you call the function, which is very convenient, I think. That is one of those things where if you're in a language that sets that permanently, then it's like just kind of a pain. You gotta basically can't have it as an argument in your method. You have to have it as the first line or something in the setup of your function inside of it. So if anybody hasn't been reading these by roots, he's going to have 4 or 5 parts talking about the performance improvements he'd been making to the JSON gem. And the things I didn't really know about, that I knew OJ was cool and fast and tried to implement JSON parsing in C. Well, turns out there's like a lot of compatibility things that it does not do that's consistent with the JSON gem. And they had run into those nuances like at Shopify and stuff. So Byroot's been making this series of blog posts talking about all the different enhancements they've been making to the JSON gem. So like there's no need to use OJ anymore. And we had like included OJ purely for the performance.
Right. Yeah.
JBuilder and whatever else, you know, you might need in Rails. So I just like read some of those articles and was like, yeah, let's just get rid of OJ. Like I did not realize that for one, the compatibility of it is not exact, which is a good enough reason for me to yank it and just stick with the JSON stuff. But now that's crazy amount more performant. And he goes through like all these different nuances of the hotspots in the gem that we're doing some encodings and whatever else. A lot of the cool stuff that goes on behind the scenes, like at the C level, that I use Ruby. I don't write Ruby itself, which is all in C. And so creating the language is, you have to be more of a C developer than a Ruby developer in a way. And I find that really interesting because I don't really dive that deep much. So he's explaining how all of these things internally work in Ruby. And it's just fascinating to learn how all that works. And that was kind of the same thing in Ruby 3.4, where like the array each and several other functions were extracted from C into Ruby, or any of the JITs could optimize that. And it's freaking awesome. Just learning the internals and understanding how they work makes for some fun reading. They're definitely deep, and you probably will need some familiarity with C to really wrap your head around it all, but he does a great job breaking it down.
I'll have to read that after we hang up this call. I checked our gem file. We do not use OJ at Podia, but yeah. I do be juicing.
Good. It's just such a subtle thing that it claims on the surface, yep, we'll make JSON parsing X number faster. And that's true, but you didn't know you were having a trade-off of compatibility or other nuances. And I think he talks about that a little bit in the first part here that you linked. Some of that stuff was load order related and how scripts were handled for safety, script tags and whatnot, and just other things like that. And that is kind of unstable. OJ used to disable the garbage collector in some cases to work around a bug, for example, which is like not what you want, especially at Shopify scale. So that kind of stuff is a good example of like, okay, we are using this because it makes it faster, but then we have all these like issues that come up because of that. So how do we address them? And Byroot's taking the approach of let's just fix the JSON gem's performance and see how far we can get it. And I mean, he's done an incredible amount of work on this, and he's still got another part, but I've just very much enjoyed reading these. They're pretty long too. It'll take you a little while to read some of these, because there's a lot.
Exciting. I just want you to know that I had to log into Twitter to get that link to put in the show notes, and 1Password auto-filled Podius Twitter into it. And I was like, oh crap, immediately signed out, and then got a message. It was like, hey, this you with like the, hey, we just noticed your Podia account signed into Twitter from a weird place. I'm like, whoops, I did it again.
Well, that's funny.
Yeah, I'm excited to read this. This is good.
You'll very much enjoy it.
I don't know a lot of C, but I know how to read code. So
you can see code.
I read a book recently called The Programmer's Brain. I haven't finished it, but I learned about this in college from an actually good professor, that code has like, there's like three main things you look for in every single language, like loops, like decisions and like, you know, methods or whatever. And once you kind of figure out like the patterns that every language is, you can kind of like piece it together. It's like, oh, I can see that this is doing iteration. Oh, I can see this is making a decision. Like, and you can kind of just piece together what's kind of happening.
Oh, yeah. You reminded me, I don't remember if this was something Colin sent me. I feel like it was a couple weeks ago. It was something related, very similar to some sort of conditional type thing where you could write it two different ways. And you might not realize that writing it one way actually generates the default value every single time, even if it's not going to be used. And so if I remember that example or where that was, I will include it in the notes. But it was one of those where it was like, oh, I write code like that sometimes. And like, I don't want it to evaluate. Oh, it was a fetch in from a hash. So if you call fetch and you say, I want to grab this key, comma, the default value, in order to call that fetch method, the default value has to be allocated and passed in as an argument and everything. But if you use the block version, then the default value only gets evaluated if the block is called. So the code inside of the block never actually runs. Whereas if you put it as arguments in there, which is just the alternative way of calling fetch with the default value, it would do the evaluation inside of the arguments. And I was like, oh, I do that. It just seemed a little cleaner to read when I put the default value in the arguments. And then I was like, well, I can't do that anymore. I'm not going to do that anymore because that is going to do extra work that's not necessary, especially if that's the common situation where there actually is a value. You just want to be careful to handle it when there isn't and you need a default. And so I thought that was really interesting where I was like, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. On the surface, it just appears to be something that is like a visual thing where you're just like, ah, I like the way this reads better. And the reality of it is like those little details of the implementation of the language can highly affect the performance of your code. And it's all that stuff that Byroot's got in these articles that are pretty much the same kind of things where it's like, we're making an assumption here, or we're not thinking about the underlying implementation enough here where we could take advantage of this other thing if we were just paying closer attention. And one of them is like being able to like have the compiler or the JIT or something take a method call and actually inline the code, because calling functions, even in C, is not cheap. And he talks about that and is like, one of the optimizations will be that the code in that function will just be copied and put directly in the function itself when it's being compiled or whatever. And that is going to save a lot of jumping around, because you have to remember that like, the reality of this is that's not very complex in the code that you look at, but the CPU instructions for it to go jump to another area of memory, it's got to store something to say, this is where we need to return to. And the amount of like small CPU operations that it has to do for that is actually where it comes from. And it might end up with a slightly larger binary on disk for the source code or whatever. The compiled version of it. Storage is cheap these days, but if you're going for performance, then you definitely don't mind if it's like even 5 megabytes larger to inline a bunch of functions or something to get that performance. And so it's always a trade-off. Maybe there is storage requirements because you're building IoT devices and they've got like 4 megabytes of flash or something that you can work with. Like there are always the trade-offs, but in our world, in Ruby and Rails in general, that's not a big deal. We want to aim for the speed. So,
speaking of optimizations like that, I read something this weekend that I'm going to put in the show notes, that it was basically you don't need loops. And it was just a massive list of ways to, it was in JavaScript, but like to avoid writing loops like with other solutions. And I just thought it was like an interesting like brain exercise. So,
yeah, because there's so many different ways of using recursion, all kinds of MapReduce, filters, yeah, lots of cool things.
And speaking of IoT, we can get into this next week because we're about at our time. It'll be a good story for next week, but I am building a magic mirror with a Raspberry Pi, and I brought you along a bit for that journey because I needed some help with the parts. But
which Raspberry Pi did you end up buying?
The 4. I might do something else with it because I was like, this, I can do other things with this. Like, this is the thing I'm going to do with it right now. Like, right now, I have a monitor in my kitchen running it, and I did figure out how to make it vertical. So, that is, it does look like it's supposed to look. I'm working on configuring it a little bit, but.
So, you were using this Magic Mirror software library. The picture at the bottom shows like a wood frame, a piece of glass and a monitor behind it? Do you need a special type of mirror that can shine light through the back?
I'm not going to build a frame for it. Like, that's too much. Like, because I have an extra monitor that I'm not doing anything with it. And I was like, this will be like a fun little thing to do with it over the Christmas break.
Dude, yeah, this is fun stuff. The cool part is, like, I think I got the 8 gig one because I'm still running Whisper on there to do transcriptions. And that needs good CPU and RAM to do all that.
I think
that.
I got the 8 too. Just in case.
I mean, it doesn't hurt. It's only like 10, 20 bucks.
Yeah. I remember how much a gig flash drive used to be. So when I saw it was like 10 bucks more for like 8, double the RAM, I was like, let's go.
You know, unless it's an Apple Mac Mini and it's like, oh, you want 2 terabytes more storage? That'll be $400.
Yeah.
I am excited though. So, well, for one, my parents got the Mac Mini, the new one, because it was fantastic. The base model price and performance is phenomenal. So they were annoyed too with the power button being underneath the corner. Mm-hmm. So I 3D printed the little stand with a nub that sits underneath and makes the entire Mac Mini a power button, basically.
Nice.
Which is great. So I'm still holding out for the new Mac Studio. But what I'm really excited about is there seems to be at least 2 or 3 companies reverse engineering the storage cards for the Mac Mini and the Mac Studios because they are removable, but the disk controller is actually built into the CPU, I think for basically better performance. And it's probably cheaper to manufacture the actual drives themselves, even though they don't sell them. But there are people working on at least half the cost. So if you want the 8 terabyte one, instead of paying $1,600 or whatever the hell they charge for that, you can basically take it apart, get one of these from these people who have taken theirs, desoldered all the chips, then sanded down every single layer of the circuit board and recreated it from scratch. And basically the problem is, like, those storage flash chips don't last forever. So people with M1 Mac Studios might have an SSD die, and then there's no way of fixing it. It's a removable thing. It's not a normal NVMe drive, but it's close. Just doesn't have all the driver controller stuff on it. And they were like, surely we could like make replacements for these. So I'm excited because if they do the M4 drives, which probably will be about the same as the Mac Mini ones, might have to do one of those, do some surgery, open heart surgery on the on there.
It's been a while since I cracked open a computer. I used to repair them. Like, that's what I did for school. So like, it's been a long time since I busted one open.
I miss that a lot. I like
miss my the IMAX. Dells.
I popped 2 sticks of RAM in there, and that was like the last thing I ever touched on a Mac. But
yeah.
I built my desktop PC last year. Well, technically 2 years ago now. Now that we're in 2025. But then I did help Jason build his rig. We just got one GPU in there. He was aiming for 2, but that
was
kind of...
What's he doing with it? What's he doing with a rig?
Well, he wanted to do some local AI stuff. So he was doing image generation and
I thought he was out here gaming or something.
No. That weekend, he came down because they don't have a micro center in Memphis. So he came up to St. Louis and we went to micro center and got... They had like a refurbished 3090, which had like a heck of a lot of GPU RAM. But what I got to realize afterwards was, I don't know if that was the most economical way to do it, because it turns out that people are using their Macs for it because of the unified memory between the CPU and GPU. And they were like, look, if you get 128 gigs of RAM in your Mac, you can allocate like 120 gigs of that RAM to the GPU or 64 or whatever you want, and then leave the rest of it for the CPU. And I was like, no way, that's kind of genius. Like, that's something that I always thought it was just a terrible thing, because that's what everybody on YouTube and the reviewers are talking about. Like, oh, it's unified, you can't upgrade it, this is just bad all around. And then when I was reading on Reddit about people doing that, I was like, wait a minute, that's actually pretty smart. Like, a real big benefit for that, because it's dynamic now. It's not just dedicated to one device. So I thought that was cool.
That's pretty smart. I'm running local models right now with Llama.
Yeah, yeah. What I'm excited about, you were talking about the Magic Mirror for the Raspberry Pi. Home Assistant, I don't use it for a ton of things, but I have like all of our devices connected. Like a lot of my lights in my office just turn off on a random time that I set, but I don't have to do it through like the Govee app or the Philips Hue app or whatever. You can all just do it in one place and like add and remove stuff or whatever. But Home Assistant's a good one to put on a Raspberry Pi. And then they just released their like first run of a local LLM powered like speaker and microphone. So you can say, hey, Jarvis or Home Assistant or whatever, and talk to it like Alexa.
That's cool.
It just doesn't have very good command recognition stuff.
Yeah. So it's like Siri.
Yeah.
Cool.
But worse.
Cool.
Probably like the first version of Siri, or maybe even worse than that.
We're still on the first version. Not okay.
Yeah, seriously. So it's really interesting though, because it runs all locally. And like, you may not want to run that on your Raspberry Pi. You might want to run the Home Assistant on your desktop in a Docker container or something. But the idea is still there. Is
yeah.
Like, I have a cheap ESP32 powered speaker and microphone that I can put in any room in my house, and talking to it will just talk to my local network at home and not go to the cloud, not be used for training and all that other stuff.
Not be given to the cops when they want it.
Yeah. I'm just like, well, and TP-Link is being threatened to be kicked from the US, and they sell all kinds of networking hardware. I have their light switches and stuff for the Toppo whatever. And it's like, I picked those because it would run locally or whatever. But yeah, I don't want to have devices that are controlled by these companies that may get banned or shut down or whatever. Like, I just want my damn stuff to work, and it doesn't need to go to the internet to turn on and off. Like, there's
right.
such simple commands to recognize for those. So I'm excited for the future on that stuff, because, you know, you can run it on a Raspberry Pi 5 and it is decent performance. It still takes 5 to 10 seconds to like parse your message or something, which is like, it's fine. It's still not what you want. You want like under 3 seconds or something for a response, but still
faster than that.
Getting there. I know, but like, even Alexa or whatever may take you 3 seconds sometimes.
Sure.
I've had that where I'm like, dude, what the hell is going on? And then you repeat it, and then it starts replying in the middle of you repeating it, and then it gets confused and whatever. So
I told you I was thinking about trying that too, because I do have some smart home stuff, but I think I told you most of the stuff I have all connects through Apple HomeKit, because I use Apple stuff. And so I naturally just bought stuff that would connect with Apple. But I know that that also makes them Apple Kit compatible. So, because they're all Matter devices.
Yeah, because Matter, I don't know how good Matter is. It was definitely in the early releases, like very bad, but I think it's gotten better. So I've got whatever brand, what is it, like Chamberlain or whatever the. They own like four garage door fans.
I looked at doing that too, but I can't replace my opener. I just wanted to tack something onto it.
So you can get the Rat Godot Rage Against the Garage Door opener. That's what that stands for.
Nice. That's
punk
rock.
Basically, you just wire it in line with the controller. So the controller stuff on the wall, the button, will just pass through the device. But then you can connect that to your Wi-Fi and then have it also send commands into the garage door opener so you can control it. Because there's stuff like that where I'm like, somebody might have taken the trash out or took the dog out and forgot to close the garage door. And I want to like a notification if it's 11 p.m. and the garage door is still open or something. Maybe just have it automatically shut down or close the door or whatever if it's open at a certain time. And then those companies like Chamberlain, everybody was pissed at them because they're like, oh, we've got our MyQ app and we want you to use that. And it's unsafe if we allow you to use our APIs, and it's unsustainable because the amount of requests and whatever. And I was like, that's some bullshit. But, you know, we're able at least to then run something locally to program that in and then use that and just can still buy those products. I don't want to support them as a business,
right.
But yet, there's not a lot of options for garage door openers. And I didn't even get to choose when we built our house. That was like what the builder bought. I don't know. Home Assistant, I think, is pretty much the only option for everything, because you can do Z-Wave devices, Zigbee, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and you're not tied in at any one specific thing. And HomeKit's got limited compatibility with stuff. So it's a good option if you have something that you can't do with HomeKit. And then Apple's supposedly building a desktop sort of countertop device for HomeKit, I guess, this coming year. That's the rumor.
Yeah, I saw that and I want that. But I don't know if I have enough devices to like justify to all that. I think I need to wait till I buy something to like really go in on all that.
Yeah, I'm curious if it'll be any good. And it's one of those things where it's like Amazon's kind of abandoned Alexa and adding stuff to it and making it better. Siri is not great. We've got a Google Home somewhere that we got for free or whatever. And like, I haven't used that in years. None of the companies really seem to be working hard on voice assistant stuff. And so I don't know that it'll make sense for me either. But I know at least my Raspberry Pi will kind of be the most compatible
exactly.
with everything.
Yeah, I'm excited to play with it more.
You reminded me, I got to go buy a cheap yellow display is what they nicknamed them. It's like an ESP32 with a little screen soldered to the backside of it. So I'm going to get one of those and you can program them with the Arduino IDE and stuff.
That's cool.
Seems like a fun project. Sad. Yeah, there's a lot of things, but then like I told you, it was like, you could do infinite amount of stuff with it, but the actual practical ideas are like very small. They're kind of like, just turn this thing off or turn it on. That's about it. You can make a mirror that displays your weather.
My RSS feed. It tells me I'm handsome, bro. Yeah, I know.
That's all you need. The
that is all I need. All right, dude. I'll catch you next week.
All right. We'll see you.